You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Is it possible that a small group of banksters, largely affiliated with one single bank, have basically taken over and ripped off much of the developed world? And, you know, certainly have their fingers in a lot of pies in the developing world, although that's a whole nother story. When the people of Greece saw their democratically elected prime minister, that was George Papandreou, when they watched him be forced out of office a year ago this month, November 2011, and replaced by an unelected, highly conservative, so-called technocrat, Lucas Papademos, who is the current prime minister. Most of the Greeks didn't realize that there was a bigger picture to what was happening all around them. Just the same as here in the United States. Back in 2008, the last year of the Bush administration, despite the switchboards at the U.S. Capitol just collapsing, I mean, literally going down, browning out, under the volume of phone calls from constituents, from Americans calling the White House to say, vote no, or calling their elected representatives as well, vote no on the bailout. Yes, there were two bailouts during the Bush administration. I know everybody likes to talk about the stimulus, the Obama stimulus, but the bailouts were bigger and they were in the Bush administration. Everybody was saying vote no. I mean, it was overwhelming vote no. So what did Bush's Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, do? He voted yes. And we got the biggest bailout of Wall Street in the 230-plus year history of this country. So what is Greece, having a conservative technocrat replace their prime minister and us bailing out the bank, what does that have to do with each other? Well, it's starting to come into focus. Now, as the Bank of England, a key player in the ongoing Eurozone crisis, announces that former investment banker Mark Carney will be its new chief, frankly, we can no longer afford to ignore what's going on around the world. Steadily and stealthily, and I am not wearing a tinfoil hat at this moment, trust me, Goldman Sachs is carrying out a global coup d'etat. There's one tie that binds Lucas Papademos in Greece, Henry Paulson here in the United States, Mark Carney in the United Kingdom, and that's Goldman Sachs. All were former bankers and executives at that Wall Street giant. All assumed prominent positions of power, and all played a hand after the global financial meltdown of 2007-2008, thus making sure that Goldman Sachs weathered the storm and made big profits in the process. But that's just scratching the surface. You think this is tinfoil hat stuff? Listen to this. Europe is collapsing into an austerity-induced economic crisis, the same one that the Republicans tried to inflict on us over the last. At that same time, who's managing the continent as it collapses? Former employees of Goldman Sachs. The British newspaper, The Independent, laid this out earlier this year. The conservative technocrats currently steering, or who have steered, post-crash fiscal policy in Greece, in Germany, in Italy, in Belgium, in France, and now running the Central Bank of the UK, all come from Goldman Sachs. In fact, the head of the European Central Bank itself, the Uber banker, Mario Draghi, his job before they put him in charge of all of Europe's central banking? Managing Director of Goldman Sachs International. Here in the United States, after Treasury Secretary, former Goldman CEO Henry Paulson did his job in 2008, making sure that Goldman's multi-billion dollar bailout was safe. He was replaced in the new Obama administration with Tim Geithner, who had worked hand in glove with Goldman Sachs when he regulated them as the head of the New York Fed. And help make sure during the Bush administration that Goldman got more than $14 billion via our bailout of IAG. We gave the money to IAG. IAG gave it to Goldman. Goldman's made whole. You know, what's happening here goes back more than a decade. In 2001, Goldman Sachs secretly helped Greece hide billions of dollars. Matt Taibbi laid this out first in Rolling Stone magazine, of all places, through the use of complex financial instruments like credit default swaps. This let Greece meet the baseline requirements to get into the Eurozone in the first place. And it also created a debt bubble. Right? Hey, things are going great here. Let's do all this on debt. You're right. That later blew up in the faces of of the Greeks and brought about the current economic crisis that's drowning the entire continent. But always looking ahead, Goldman protected itself from the debt bubble by betting against their own Greek bonds, expecting that they would eventually fail. Ironically, the guy who headed up the central bank of Greece while this deal was being cut with Goldman Sachs was, drumroll please, Lucas Papademos, the current prime minister of Greece. Goldman made similar deals here in the United States, masking the true value of investments, then selling those worthless investments to customers while placing bets that those same investments would eventually fail. The most notorious was the Timberwolf deal. Remember that? When the good senator from Michigan, that was Mr. Levin, was it not? As I recall, kept using that S-word on the air. It brought down an Australian hedge fund. The Goldman Sachs banksters emailed to each other about it, bragging, boy, that Timberwolf was one SC deal, if you know what I mean. This sort of behavior by Goldman helped inflate and then eventually pop the housing bubble right here in the United States. And the shockwave then ran across the Atlantic, hitting Europe and turning Goldman's debt masking deal with Greece that they had made a few years before, turned it sour and deepened the crisis. Now, all of this stuff should have brought about the end of Goldman. But with their alumni and key policy positions on both sides of the Atlantic, not only did Goldman Sachs survive, they're doing very well, thank you very much. Daily Kos sums it up. The normal scenario usually involves helping a nation hide a problem and sell its debt until the problem blows up into a bubble that bursts in a spectacular way. Goldman Sachs then puts their man into a position of power to direct the bailout so that Goldman gets all its money back and more while the nation's economy gets gutted. End of quote. You know, for years, tinfoil hat crazies who've bookmarked Glenn Beck's websites and often appear as experts on Fox so-called news have been warning us, there's a world, one world government coming. Latest threat, according to them, Agenda 21. That's a Soviet-style authority. It's going to confiscate private property. It's going to redistribute wealth. It's going to force us all to live. Global warming. Oh, my God, that's terrible. It's totalitarian government. Don't worry about the corporations, they say. Don't even talk about the banksters. But when you take off that tinfoil hat, you can see that the sort of world government that has already been established, it's far more subtle, but it's pretty conspicuous. It's the rise of Goldman Sachs and their colleagues in the Wall Street elite. You look at the world this way, and you know, it raises lots of questions, but a lot of those questions can be answered once you realize that Goldman alumni from Goldman Sachs have executed basically a global coup d'etat. You know, why are the working people of Greece, Portugal, Spain, and Italy, and increasingly here in the United States and the United Kingdom, being, you know, suffering under austerity, being asked to sacrifice their pensions, their wages, and their jobs, when after 5 years, it's really obvious that these austerity measures are just making things worse? Why? Because Goldman Sachs is sucking the marrow out of the bones of these countries before they throw them away.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's time for America to wake up and say, hey, you know, even Reagan sent banksters to jail. What's up? Grover is fighting back. Yesterday I was calling him an enemy of the state. In fact, published a piece to that effect on the interwebs that's kind of all over the place. What? How dare you call me an enemy of the state? Actually, what he's been doing a bunch of these appearances, and the Center for American Progress, Igor Volsky, over there, has summarized his talking points for us. And number one, he says, for 4 years, Obama has not reined in spending, done nothing useful on entitlement reform. Actually, Obama has cut spending considerably. You know, I'm not going to go through all the boring details with you, but they're there. And he also significantly reformed Medicare, which is, you know, one of the bigger entitlement programs, by folding it into the Affordable Care Act and putting some, you know, real rational limits is the wrong word, you know, a structure to it so it would work. Grover Norquist says, this is where we were. That's where we were with Reagan tax rates, and that's where we were with the lower marginal tax rates. And with reasonable economic growth, we got revenues 18% of GDP, blah-de-blah-de-blah. He says, if we went back to the Reagan rates, 11 million workers would be at work today. Well, actually, you know, Reagan didn't drop the top tax rate below 50% until 1986. It was in the fifth year of his presidency. And it didn't work out so well. In fact, here, by the mid-1990s, it was the consensus view of economists that the tax reform of 1986 had little, if any, impact on growth. But, you know, Grover keeps peddling this stuff. He says, when Bush cut marginal tax rates on capital gains and dividends, there were 4 years of strong economic growth. It had nothing to do with it. And, by the way, why do you want to cut top marginal tax rates on dividends and income? Now, because people don't understand how this works, they say, well, you know, the top tax rate on dividends and income is 15% right now. And so somebody who is earning $20,000, $30,000 a year living on Social Security with a small pension, and they're getting, say, $500 a month in dividends and interest income from their investments, they hear that and they think, oh, my God, I'm paying 15% income tax on that $500 a month. No, you're paying nothing in income tax because your total income puts you below the poverty level. So, you know, the capital gains tax is indexed, it's a progressive tax. It's got, you know, it's like stair steps to it, just like the regular income tax does. So you don't pay that 15% unless you're making over a couple hundred thousand a year. Like Mitt Romney. That's why Mitt Romney pays 14%, 13%. It was 15% before he pulled out a couple million to give to the Mormons. That made, you know, a tax deductible, a loophole. One of those loopholes, right? So, again, I just keep coming back to this question that I ask on this program over and over and over again, and I've never had a conservative give me a rational answer for it or to it. Which is, why do we tax surgeons who save lives at 36%? And we tax banksters who make millions or billions at 15%. Why does Mitt Romney have a 15% maximum income tax rate and the surgeon who saved Louise's life has a maximum 36% income tax rate? What's so magical about Mitt Romney? And these conservatives come on and they say, well, you know, because he's a job creator. And I'd say, no, I don't think so. He's a bankster. He's stashed his money in the Cayman Islands. I mean, maybe he's creating a job in the Caymans. You know, some guy's got to keep track of those hundreds and hundreds of safety deposit boxes and mail drops, I suppose. Or in Switzerland, you know, to Swiss Bank over at UBS, but job creator? No. They say, well, it's because capital is taxed twice, you know. It's taxed once at the corporate level and then once at the individual level. A, half the time it's not even true because, you know, these pass-through provisions, this thing called carried interest. But B, even if that's the case, it's a nonsensical argument. Pull a dollar out of your pocket and take a look at it. That dollar's probably been taxed 1,000 times. Every time it changes hands, go into the store and buy something. You're going to pay sales tax. The store owner then, you know, gives that, says, makes a profit. He pays a tax on that. takes that part, you know, that dollar is a piece of what's left over. He uses it to pay an employee. The employee pays a tax on that. The employee goes out and, you know, buys a product from, you know, one of my sponsors. And, you know, they pay a tax on it. And then they take that dollar and give it to us to talk about them on the radio. And, hey, it's gone the full circle, but it's been taxed a whole bunch of times. That, you know, this is a nonsensical argument. These guys have succeeded in creating this notion that the Goldman Sachs of the world, who pay a maximum 15% income tax, are somehow a sacred elite. As I pointed out yesterday, the royal family of England has nothing on the billionaires of America in terms of wealth, particularly the Walton family. It's stunning. So how is it that we buy this stuff? I mean, do we buy this story, that we accept this story that's been spoon-fed to us since the Reagan administration, that we should cut taxes on capital gains and dividend interest because somehow it's going to help retired people with their savings? Well, I'm sorry, they're not paying taxes on it anyway. Well, it might help the millionaires and billionaires in their retirement. Well, yeah. But do they really need that help? Or should they be paying their fair share of running this country too, which they're not paying, by the way? These are some of the issues that are going to come up this week and next in these tax negotiations here in Capitol Hill, here in Washington, D.C., that we all need to be talking about.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if any of you conservatives out there can explain to me why Mitt Romney should pay a lower income tax rate than the surgeon who saved my wife's life, give me a call. From the Weapons of Mass Deception, Tom Hartman here with you. And yes, Ken Cuccinelli thinks it's the end of the world as we know it. He's convinced. Well, he later walked it back, but he was convinced on the radio when he was talking to a right-wing host that this, Ken Cuccinelli, the attorney general for the state of Virginia, who has announced that next year he's going to run for governor. Ken Cuccinelli, that Obama won because we didn't have enough states that had voter ID laws. Because according to Cuccinelli, in all the states that had voter ID laws, Obama lost. Proving that if you ask people for driver's licenses, Obama would lose. I guess proving that, you know, a lot of those people who voted for Obama were actually not citizens. Don't ask me to explain the rationale or the logic behind this insanity, but this was his point. It turns out there are four states that have very strict voter ID laws. They are Indiana, Georgia, Kansas, and Tennessee, and sure enough, the president didn't carry any of those states. But there are other states that also have voter ID laws that are not quite as draconian as those four states. Those four states, by the way, I don't think any Democrat has carried them since maybe Lyndon Johnson or Jack Kennedy, and maybe not even that. But in any case, the other states that do have photo ID laws and that Obama did carry are Florida, Hawaii, Michigan, and New Hampshire. So even the premise is nonsense. But thought you'd want to know. It's pretty amazing. It's actually quite amazing. And now a host on Fox News, the 129 people in Bangladesh have died in factory fires over the last week or so. Factories where they make stuff for Walmart, where they had chained the workers into the factories, where they had no automatic sprinklers, where they had, you know, in one case, after the fire alarm went off, the managers told the mostly women employees to go back to their stations where they were sewing, and they died. And so a Fox News host, Charles Payne, Fox Business. These people were grateful to have a job, don't you know? Well, here's the actual quote. It is tragic. I don't think something like this will happen again. Don't think that the people in Bangladesh who perished didn't want or need those jobs as well. I know we like to victimize everyone in this country, particularly when it comes to our for-profit motivation, which has been assaulted. But, you know, it's a tragedy. But I think it is a stretch, an amazing stretch to try to pin this on Walmart. But, of course, the unions in this country are desperate. Yeah. We will have more about that in the third hour of the program, among other things. And in the next hour of the program, Noel Flasterstein is going to drop by. Gun Rights for You. Yeah, Tiny Tots with their machine guns all aglow.
Oh, no.
Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, thanks for calling. What's on your mind today?
This is Your Choice Tuesday. What would you like to talk about, the coup d'etat of Goldman Sachs or the fiscal cliff?
Well, I think it's all one and the same, and according to my note here, you called about the fiscal cliff, so let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, the fiscal cliff, we have some terrible negotiators. Now, you got to load the table up before you start bargaining.
Right.
I mean, you got to put on the table transaction tax on Wall Street. You got to put on their carbon tax. You have to go after everything sacred to the Republicans.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And that's not being done. Instead, they're debating whether or not to put Medicare on there.
Yeah, I mean, what do you want? All right, you want to put Medicare on? Let's put the transaction tax against Wall Street up against that Medicare.
Yeah, there you go.
You want something else? We'll put the carbon tax up against that.
Yeah.
What do you want to give up?
And also the other another thing that should be on the table is why are the capital gains taxes at why does Mitt Romney pay a different tax rate than doctors do? Why? And that should be on the table. I totally agree with you, Corky. Well said. Damien in Manorville, New York. Hey, Damien says you disagree with me. What's up?
Tom, my favorite liberal, man. You know, you really are.
Here's
my comment about the taxes.
Uh-huh.
You know what? It is unfair that the doctor pays, 36% and Mitt Romney or any other executive is getting 15%. That's why everybody should pay 15%. And then it is...
And then we'd have no roads, we'd have no schools, we'd have no fire departments,
No. There's been more studies that have said that when you lower federal income tax, that the federal government actually takes in more revenue because people are spending more.
Damien, what are you smoking?
Seriously.
I want to avoid it, whatever it is. I'm quite serious. There are no reasonable economists out there. Well, actually, forget economists. Simple question. What is the 30-year period, the three consecutive decade period in the history of the United States that showed the highest growth, the fastest growth of corporations, the fastest growth in job creation, and the fastest growth of wages for the middle class? What was that? What were those three decades?
I'll say
the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. Let me make it easy for you. Now, what was the top tax rate during that time?
Well, it was explicit.
It was 91% for most of it.
You really think? Oh, I'm just now. You're a reasonable guy. You really think that if somebody has a dollar, the government should take 91 cents?
If it is
the, come on.
Damien, I think you're missing a fundamental reality here. If someone has a dollar, if somebody earns a dollar, the government takes nothing out of it. Well, actually, they take 4% out of it for Social Security tax. But beyond that, nothing.
Which they should raise.
Okay. But if somebody is earning $1 million, the question is what percentage of the million and first dollar after that $1 million should the government be taking? Back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, if you earned about $1 million in today's income, after that point, the government started taking 91%. Before that point, the government was taking 50%, 30%, 20%, 10%. In fact, most Americans up until the big inflation of the 70s, more than half of Americans were not paying any federal income taxes at all, pretty much like now, because the tax rates were skewed toward the top.
But, Tom, if you just think about it as fundamental fairness across the board, it is immoral for somebody. Look, let's just put this. I guarantee you make more money than me. I'll guarantee that, you know. Now, let's just say this. Let's say we went out to dinner and the check comes. And then I read it off with, you had a meal, I had a meal. It was about the same price. And then the bill comes out to $200. And you know what? I put $30 down on the table. and you go, what's going on here? Well, you know what, Tom, you make a lot more money than me, so, you know, you should be paying more of the bill than I should. You know, and, you know, that's kind of the same way. You know,
Damien, that's crazy. If we're going to dinner in a restaurant, that's something that we're doing for fun and for entertainment. It is purely discretionary. Let's say instead that you're living in a house and I'm living in a house and they're next door to each other and that your house is a mansion and my house is a mobile home and they both catch on fire and the fire trucks come to put them out and put them both out. Should we both pay the exact same amount in property taxes to pay for the cost of the fire department? Because they're going to spend hours putting out your mansion and it's going to take them 5 minutes to put out my mobile home?
No, there should be, I guess, an adjustment. But my point is...
So the rich people who use more of the courts, who use more, you know, more than half of all court activity in the United States is rich people and large corporations defending their money, basically.
And you know how much money they pay those attorneys?
That's not a point. That is purely discretionary. That's not taxes. I'm talking about the commons.
The time, Tom. I'm just saying this. If I don't care who it is, if you earn a dollar, it's fundamentally wrong to say to somebody, think about it, it's discriminatory taxation.
Here's what I find amazing. Damien, I'm genuinely baffled by this. If you're certain that enlighten me here. This is an honest question. No gotchas. If you genuinely believe that you make less than me, and that you have an average income or a middle class income or working class, whatever it may be, that, you know, why are you worried? Since your income tax, your federal income tax, probably isn't above 15 or 20% anyway, because you have to make a hell of a lot just to get that. Why are you worried about the income tax rate on the Koch brothers going from 36 to 39.5%?
It's because it's fundamental fairness. It is not right. Look, I don't believe that they should be meddling like they do in politics. I'll say that. The problem, though, is, and I don't believe that they should be doing illegal things and shipping jobs overseas. I don't want you getting the wrong idea. However, but if somebody makes $1 billion, $1 million, how is that affecting me personally? Why should
Let me explain how it's affecting you personally. During the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when people like the Koch brothers paid a maximum 91% income tax, the growth of the second, third, and fourth quintiles, in other words, the middle of America, from the bottom 20% up to the top 20%, that area in between, okay, from 20% to 80%, those people, which is most of all of us, most Americans, saw our incomes grow faster than the very poor, which has always pretty much been the case, and faster than the very rich. Ever since Reagan came into office, that has flipped upside down because of tax policy. The very rich, since Reagan's inauguration, have seen an increase in their income of 275%. Average working people like you, Damien, have seen your income actually go down.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that's why I'm baffled, Damien, about why you are worried about the Koch brothers making the extra 275%.
Chipmunks roasting on an open fire.
Chipmunks? What?
Hot sauce dripping from their toes.
Oh, no. I don't like where this song is going.
Yuletide squirrels, fresh filleted by the choir. They poked hot skewers through their nose.
Oh. You know, I was at the founding meeting of PETA.
Some pepper and a garlic clove help to make them seasoned right. Tiny rats with a crisp golden coat will really hit the spot tonight.
Yes. If you're going to hear Christmas songs, you might as well hear ones that are, you know, funny, I suppose. We've been playing that for years in the weeks going up to the holiday season. I love that pastiche. Mark, as much as I'm horrified by the imagery. Mark in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Mark, tax dollars go toward creating more jobs than Romney's tax breaks. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Explain.
I'm sorry. Absolutely. I mean, you know, most of his money seems to be flowing offshore into other places. So when the government turns around, it's not like it's stashing it in a savings account offshore. The government spends all the money it takes in.
Mm-hmm.
It spends it on those projects you were talking about.
By and large,
so,
yes.
In terms of job creator, I mean, you know, the government's a much better job creator in many cases than these multimillionaires ever thought of being.
Yes. Amen. And we know now that for every dollar invested just in unemployment compensation, I mean, literally just giving people money who don't have jobs, you get $2 worth of economic activity. And that's in today's economy where, it, you know, fairly quickly, most of that money ends up going overseas because we
right.
don't have a VAT tax. We don't have tariffs anymore.
A couple other things briefly. I mean, that money doesn't stop at the government. You know, it goes back into the hands of workers on projects, and then they spend. So it has many indirect effects throughout the economy as well.
Yes. It's
also that gentleman that called in earlier, he was really way off base when he talks about the wealthy creating jobs as well, because you know, the Koch brothers, they don't work all that work. They don't do all that. It's their workers that do that.
Well, yeah,
you know,
they are creating jobs, though, for
the money.
They are creating jobs for right-wing hacks to go on talk shows and spout their talking points.
Yeah, it's a good industry for them.
Yeah.
One final point. I know you have...
But do we want to subsidize that with, you know, by keeping their taxes low? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. And then, you know, he was rattling on about immoral, like debt is immoral.
Right.
You know, in 2008, it was the freezing of the ability to lend and borrow money that was the immediate threat to the markets as a whole.
Yep.
Everybody runs on debt.
Yep.
Business every day borrows money to make payroll and do other things. So people need to just, you know, take the immoral argument and leave it behind in the medieval.
The part of it, Mark, that in my opinion is immoral is that we have a system in which one of the principal sources of profit in our economy is interest. And you know, which is prohibited by the Bible and other sacred texts. And the reason why it's always been prohibited is because interest is a way that banksters basically always win and rip everybody off. And banking should be done the way it's done in the Muslim countries, in many of the Muslim countries, which is no interest charges whatsoever. Instead, you charge a fee on the services that you provide. You want to write a check? That's fine. That check is going to cost you 10 cents. You want to have a savings account? That's fine. The savings account is going to cost you, you know, $100 a year or whatever. But, you know, if we're going to provide you with banking services, you're going to pay us for those services a reasonable price rather than interest. And go ahead.
There is that, and I can agree with that to a point. But I would note that, you know, my wife and I bank with a credit union, mm-hmm. and they still charge the interest rates. But, you know, they're nonprofits, and it's limited, and it's not usury.
You actually are an owner of that credit union if you are banking with that credit union. So you're actually paying interest to yourself, and that's the one context in which I agree with you. It makes sense. Mark, thank you for the call. Craig in Blanchardville, Wisconsin. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Yes, in regard to raising capital gains tax on millionaires, you already mentioned that they pay tax on their earnings already. But what you didn't mention is that these guys don't know what they're going to make on their earnings. The surgeon you talked about, he knows what he's going to make every month, every year. But when you invest money, you don't know if you're going to make anything on it. You don't get a tax credit if you lose your money.
Actually, you do. You can carry forward losses, and you can carry back losses 3 years. You can't do that if you have a bad year as a surgeon or if you have a bad year as a shopkeeper. Investors, you know, I guarantee you, as we speak, Mitt Romney's amending his 2010 tax returns to drop his 14% rate down to the 11% rate that he could have claimed if he had chosen not to take, you know, not to claim some of those deductions to the Mormon Church. So, no, I'm sorry, you're wrong, Craig. Appreciate the call, though. Dave in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Dave, you wanted to comment on taxes?
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I just have an observation to make, and my thinking is this, that all of the discourse that I hear is muddled in minutiae around taxes and fairness and all that. And
I think that it's easy to get lost in the minutiae of things if you don't think of it in a historical perspective or in a theoretical perspective. And I'm going to ask you, with your intellect and your knowledge of these things, to think about doing that. I haven't heard you do it yet.
I'm not sure what you're talking about. And, Dave, we're just about out of time.
I'm trying to organize my thoughts. Bear with me. What I'm trying to say is that the moneyed elites have forever ruled the world and exploited the rest of us, and it's no different now. The moneyed elites are ruling the world.
Actually, there have been periods when it was different. You know, Roosevelt put the moneyed elites in their place, and for 30 or 40 years, the moneyed elites actually saw their wealth grow more slowly than the middle class. That's an anomaly in American history, but it happened. And frankly, I think it can happen again. And we need to keep that in mind, that there was a time in this country, a 40-year period of time, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, when the top 1% saw their income grow at a rate that was slightly slower than that of the middle class. Why? Because of the top tax income tax rates. And it was a good and healthy thing. They still got rich, but so did everybody else.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, this is interesting. Three people were arrested when naked protesters stormed John Boehner's office, saying, "Don't be a dick, John." Look at how his name is spelled. Let's not go there. Noel Flasterstein is with us. He is an attorney and host of The Gun Show. GunRightsForYou.com is the website. Tiny tots with their machine guns aglow, and I can't sing. Hey, Noel, welcome. Welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. This gun club owner says that it's a holiday tradition for kids to hold machine guns in photos with Santa. Machine guns are designed to kill people. Why would anybody want to put into the mind of a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old or a 4-year-old the idea that here is something that is designed for killing human beings?
Well, I think if we just look at the simple fact that, you know, sometimes we maintain peace through strength. And I don't know why these individuals or this club likes to celebrate their holidays and memorialize it with pictures of kids with machine guns and Santa. But at the same time, you know, I don't have a problem with that. And that's, you know, the individual's creative choice on how they want to memorize their or, you know, memorialize their holidays.
Well, I do have a problem with that. I think that this is child abuse. I think that to say to a child, as you just suggested, hey, it's a dangerous world, and sometimes you have to stand up for yourself. Here is an AK-47. It goes way beyond the advice that, you know, some parents give to their kids of, you know, if the bully, you know, punches you, punch him back. This now is if the bully punches you, you know, blow his guts out.
Well, I think that's making quite a stretch. Even Martin Luther King, you know, the one of our great public figures who, you know, peaceful demonstrations and peaceful resistance. Even he twice applied to have a gun permit.
When he was 7 years old?
Huh?
When he was 7 years old?
No, not when he was 7 years old.
I mean, Martin Luther King, was getting death threats.
I don't think we need to hide and shelter children from the world we live in. The kids in Gaza and Israel experience it on a daily basis.
And all the more the tragedy. Are you saying that we should be celebrating that? Let's give these kids some pictures of blown up kids with cluster bombs or, you know, white phosphorus burning their flesh away. That'll make them happy for Christmas.
Well, sometimes I don't think we have to show them pictures when they're seeing it right in front of their eyes. And, you know, it's unfortunate.
But you're supporting a gun club owner who says that it's a holiday tradition for kids to pose with Santa and a machine gun. And it seems to me that this is taking this fetishization of guns. And as you know, Noel, I am no opponent of gun ownership in the United States. And in fact, I'm a competitive shooter occasionally. I mean, not in any big professional way. It's mostly me and my brother. But, you know, I don't have a problem with that. I don't hunt. I just have no interest in killing anything. But I'm not some absolute no way, never, no, you know, but a 7-year-old, you know, taking a picture with, you know, maybe, you know, a toy BB gun, maybe. I mean, I had one when I was 7 years old, you know, the Annie Oakley special, or maybe it was the, who was Annie Oakley's, what was it, Roy Rogers, wasn't it? No. Yeah, the Roy Rogers, I had the Roy Rogers special when I was a little kid. But that wasn't an AK-47. That was not a weapon of war. That was not something that is designed. You know, the whole theory of, you know, back then was that you rode your horse around the Wild West and you carried a gun mostly to protect yourself from snakes.
Well, maybe the picture of the child with his AK-47 or M16 sitting on Santa's lap is intent to be a message to the Islamists that want to, you know, make America an Islamic nation subject to Sharia law. And if people want to, and, you know, express themselves, they have a First Amendment right, and they want to express themselves utilizing their Second Amendment with their child, you know, let them have at it. There are many things people do that may not necessarily agree with, but I respect
the
right to creatively do what they do.
That makes a lot of sense. Somebody over in Pakistan, a drone comes down and kills their brother and their 10-year-old niece, and they're really, really upset with America. And I mean, this is actually the story of the Times Square bomber, as you probably know. You know, he had family that was killed by a drone strike, and so they decide to they're thinking about coming to America to blow us up in revenge for our killing their innocent civilians. But they decide first to look at Christmas pictures on the internet. And going through the Christmas pictures, they see some 7-year-olds with AK-47s, and they say, gee, maybe we shouldn't go to America. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying, if a person wants to express themselves and say, hey, we're going to protect Christmas from those who want to do away with it, then let them express themselves.
But a 7-year-old?
It doesn't hurt anyone.
A 7-year-old? Really?
Look, I have a 7-month-old son, and I assure you, when he's 5, he's going to get a .22 rifle. In fact, I don't think I'm going to even let him have a toy gun. To me, a toy gun is an oxymoron. It's oxymoronic. But he will have
the BB gun that I have.
My adult supervision and instruction, and I will teach him the safety and danger of it. And in fact, I shouldn't be so worried about him having a real .22 rifle. I have to be more worried about it when he goes swimming or when he gets in a car, which the statistics have shown is more likely to lead to his death than a firearm through an accidental and or intentional shooting. And you don't have to take my word for it. Just go to the Centers for Disease Control, where the government nicely keeps the statistics of what kills our children. It's not guns. Well, if they do on occasion, but there's more greater threats and dangers to our children than firearms. And
but you know, if you've looked at the CDC stats, that the number of kids who are killed by guns accidentally or as suicide attempts vastly outweighs the number of kids who are, you know, who are involved in some sort of a firefight where they protect themselves with a gun. It's virtually non-existent. Well, again, the question, and you know, I get it. You want to give your kid a 22. Why a 22 and not a 357 Magnum? I mean, if you're going to give them a weapon of death, why not just go all the way?
Because I don't think you'll be able to handle a 357 Magnum.
Because the kick would hurt him.
As a child, as a 5-year-old, but I do think you'll be able to handle a 22 rifle, .22 caliber.
Then why not?
Rifle.
Why not do something like start. Why not do what my dad did with me and give him a BB gun that actually you can use for target practice? I mean, my brother and I set up a target thing in our backyard, and we used to shoot the BB guns at that target thing. I mean, and if we missed or if we hit somebody, you didn't kill them. I mean, you could take an eye out. It's one of the reasons why there's not so many BB guns around. But those were different times, I suppose. But it's still, I don't get this fetishizing of guns. Other than, you know, maybe, you know, some people are just deeply insecure and they feel like they have to have something that's big and long and goes bang.
Maybe some people do. I don't have it because of that. I lived most of my adult life without a gun until somebody tried to break into my residence. The problem with the BB gun is I think that would encourage my child to maybe shoot another kid and maybe shoot birds. Like you, I'm a big gun advocate. Well, but I don't, you know, I have to support hunters' rights, but for me, that's nothing I'm going to do when I got a local grocery store as long as I decide to continue eating meat. But I don't encourage hunting. I'm definitely not going to encourage my child, whether he decides to do that when he gets older.
But you're not going to join me in condemning a group that's putting 7-year-olds and Santa in the same picture with an assault weapon.
I see nothing wrong with it. You know, we might think it's a little kooky. It might not be for you. It might not be for your child or your grandchild. But if some parent wants to do that, and maybe they're teaching their children. You know, most of the adult friends that I have that were raised around guns, that had guns in their home, because I grew up in a redneck area of Florida, a little town called Plant City. Right. Guns were aplenty.
Those people respect guns. No, I don't disagree with you on that. I just, you know, the Christmas picture is the part that makes me crazy. Neil, we're out of time, but thanks for dropping by. Neil Plasterson.
Have a
good
one.
Thanks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Neil's website, of course, is gunrightsforyou.com. We'll be right back.
Give me a gun and some Viagra and
the new Hustler. Scooter in Yuma, Arizona. Hey, Scooter, what's on your mind?
How you doing, sir?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Scooter. How about you?
You're looking at it here.
Okay.
Yeah, I heard you talking about guns and kind of ruffled my feathers a little bit.
Well, I'm sorry. Well, actually, I'm not. Yeah. What about what I said ruffled your feathers? I thought I was being quite reasonable.
I didn't get the whole conversation, but this is the way I look at it, sir. I have no problem with anti-gun laws from state to state, okay? I do not believe, you want to call it an AK-47, fine, but I don't believe the federal government should ban those. Well, I heard a rumor, I don't know if it's true, but I heard that as soon as Obama won re-election, he called up Dianne Feinstein, champion of anti-gun bill, said, "Get me a gun bill."
No, actually, it's the opposite. That's the story that, you know, I mean, that story has reappeared over and over and over again. Obama has expanded gun rights. He's allowed us to carry guns on Amtrak. He's allowed us to carry guns into national parks. Both of those things were against the law under George W. Bush. Under George W. Bush, we had the assault weapons ban. It expired. Obama has not renewed it.
He let it pass.
Yep.
But you watch. I bet you that you're going to get another. Another one of those, and I heard that any.
I wish we did. Like, I think the assault weapons ban was a good thing, but I agree with you that municipalities and states should be able to make their own slightly or even highly more restrictive gun laws if that's what they want. New York City is a very different place than rural Vermont, and therefore they should have different rules and regulations regarding firearms. But I'm not. I don't get where you're disagreeing with me. My point was giving a 7-year-old an assault weapon and putting them on Santa's lap for their annual Christmas picture is weird.
It is weird, but hey, it's a picture.
I guarantee
that gun wasn't loaded. But can I make a
How
point,
does a 7-year-old know?
Well, you make
turn around and try and shoot Santa, I guess they'd find out.
Let me make my point.
Which, by the way, is the title of our article in Hustler.
I volunteer work down for the state Game and Fish Department. I'm a big hunter.
Uh-huh.
And we go down here on the border where the desert bighorn sheep and mule deer are. We build these waterhole projects for them.
Mm-hmm.
The cartel members are down there with AK-47s. We have had shootings down
at campsites.
You're kidding. What happened?
You're hunting with an AK-47? That's not a sportsmanlike, Scooter. That's cheating.
Well, listen to me, sir. I'm protecting myself. I have a right to be on American soil.
What, from other hunters?
Side of the border. And if another, either a coyote guy that brings in the illegals or the drug pushers, what happens is they see you, they come right at you, and they shoot at you because they're scared that you're going to call the Border Patrol. And if they lose their load, the cartels will have them killed.
So how many hunters were killed last year on the U.S. border while they were legitimately hunting varmints instead of anything else? How many hunters? I think the number is zero.
Well, I know that two hunters about 6 years ago were killed at a mountain range that I'm looking at about 15 miles.
Okay, so two guys died 6 years ago, and therefore everybody running around loose should be carrying an assault weapon. Scooter, you're not making sense to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's just the way I believe it.
See, I think this falls into the same category as you know, we have 450,000 Americans who die every year from smoking. Okay, you got another 50,000 Americans who die every year from alcohol. That's just from alcohol use, right? From cirrhosis and alcohol-associated diseases. You have another 40,000 Americans who die every year from car accidents that had something to do with alcohol. My point is not that we should be banning those things, but we've had over the last 10 years an average of maybe 100 people a year, and that's including the 3,000 people on 9/11. You take them out, and it's an average of maybe 5 people a year killed by terrorists in the United States. Why is it that I've got to spend an hour and lots of my tax dollars going through all this nonsense with the TSA and airport security, when I want to fly out and visit my kids for the holidays, and nobody is jumping up in front of somebody with a cigarette saying, hey, wait a minute, the 450,000 people are going to die this year. This is insane.
It seems to me that it's the same category.
Like you're saying that two guys got shot 6 years ago, and therefore everybody should carry an AK-47 is like TSA saying 3,000 people died 12 years ago, and therefore we're going to spend $1 trillion, patting down grandma.
Right. Well, I believe it's in 96 or 97, Kennesaw County, Georgia, mandated firearms.
No, it was in the 80s. I was living there when it happened. I wasn't living in Kennesaw. I was living in Roswell.
It fell down dramatically.
No, it's not true.
The armed society is a polite society.
Scooter, go to Snopes.com and look up the story of Kennesaw, Georgia. I'm telling you, I lived in Roswell, Georgia, which is basically the next town over from Kennesaw. Well, it's the next county over from Kennesaw. There's so few people in that town. They passed that gun law that said you had to have a gun. A, nobody ran out and got a gun. It was a joke. It was a statement. And B, there was no increase. There was no decrease in gun violence because there basically is no gun violence in Kennesaw, Georgia. Never has been. Never will be. It's a little town.
There's a decrease in crime, and the people that couldn't afford it, they just give them the police trade-ins. Mandated it.
No, I'm sorry, Scooter. You have been reading too many tinfoil hat websites. I'm serious.
I got a tinfoil hat. Looks like a sailor hat I'm wearing right now. Look, all I got to say is I respect California for their anti-gun laws, but I won't move over there. My parents have a house in Salinas, California. I was there for 2.5 weeks caring for my father. They had more gun crime in those 2 weeks than we have in Yuma all year.
Well, they got more people in California.
No, Salinas is about the same size. It's a lettuce-based industry. Yuma and Salinas are connected, and they have – you can't even roll around with a gun. It has to be separated, the bullets and locked and all this stuff.
Right.
How can you defend yourself if somebody holds up anything? If some guy holds a gun to you, I cannot save your life because I've got my bullets locked up separately.
Yeah, here's the question, Scooter. Given the average American, and I don't mean that as a slur, do you really want to put your life in the hands of just, the guys who show up at football games as opposed to professional police officers? I'm a little wary of that. I just personally, just speaking for myself. Scooter, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As much as I think, law enforcement has been over-militarized in the United States, and frankly, they're wildly underpaid, I'd prefer they're carrying the guns than us.
Tom, I think you're all mentally ill because you have this hatred, this passionate hatred for conservatives and for white people.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Yeah, it did sound odd, Jim. Jim, speaking of Jim in Woodstown, New Jersey. Hey, Jim. You think that people need to be armed to protect themselves from the government? I suppose in Congress, July 4th, 1776, Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence wrote, speaking of King George III, it was the third by that time, "He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures." Am I setting up the ball for you to on the tee here for you to knock it out?
Sort of. Here's an example, okay? In 1967, I was in the 82nd Airborne Division. The whole 1st Brigade was trained in riot training during the winter. And in the summer of 67, when they had riots, they sent my battalion to Detroit to stop the riots there. We took care of it.
So wait a minute, you were in the Army or you were in the National Guard?
I was in the active Army, 82nd.
That's a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act.
Well, whatever. But when we got there, we solved the whole problem within 24 hours, but we shot a lot of people, okay?
Yikes.
More than I'd like to discuss. But what I'm saying
is... So you shot, as an American soldier, you shot American citizens, civilians on American soil.
Correct.
That's a bad, that's a stain on our history.
I'm
speaking of the situation. I understand you were doing what you were told.
If those people had been armed, they could have resisted much better than what they did, and it took a whole battalion to calm down a city that, in the terms of a popular uprising against a repressive government, the American people could stop a repressive government if they were armed. If they're not armed, they're going to have happen to them the same thing that happened to the people in Detroit.
Well, let me ask you a question, Jim. I'm sure you have a passing familiarity, at least, with modern weaponry, modern military weaponry.
Yeah.
If, let's say, your battalion were to show up in a city in the United States that was experiencing an insurrection, and if the civilians of that city were armed with everything from pistols to assault weapons, what would y'all do?
We'd have a real battle on our hands.
And I don't think so.
I can tell you how I even know about that. I was also part of the 82nd when we went to Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic for that uprising.
Right, and you didn't go in, well, maybe you did, but it seems to me like the smart way would not be to go in with a bunch of foot soldiers carrying weapons that are basically matched weapon for weapon against the civilians. The smart way to go in, if you're the military, is with Black Hawk helicopters, and as much as I hate to say it, and smart way is maybe the wrong way to say it, but with weapons of mass destruction, with bombs and Gatling guns that are mounted on helicopters and fighter jets, and isn't that, in your mind, what would have been the next step in Detroit if the citizenry was armed, that you then would have just
Correct.
Taken out entire city blocks with rockets? And
Correct.
If so, how could, how can you still make a case that the citizenry should be armed to stop an oppressive government? Really, the case you're making is a case that Jefferson made, that the founders and framers made, that the military should always be under civilian control, that the chief executive of the military, the commander in chief of the military, should be the elected president of the United States, not somebody who was a professional military person.
And of course, we were there. LBJ was the president.
I know.
That's all we had going on in Vietnam. I mean, he also sent us to the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, I know.
We basically beat them because we outmanned them as far as guns and heavy
No,
guns.
But the point that I'm making is that your argument that Americans should be armed to the teeth with small arms in order to overcome an oppressive government, should that day ever come, that argument doesn't make any sense. Because if you have a genuinely oppressive government, they're going to kick your ass if all you've got is an assault weapon.
But at the same token, if we had the weapons, they could only control the cities. The countryside, they could not control, just like in Afghanistan today.
Well, of course they could. Well, that's what they make napalm for.
But we are not controlling Afghanistan because those people have a history of war, and they don't care who they're fighting, just so everybody leaves them alone.
We don't control Afghanistan because they are fighting for their homes. And that's why I don't think that you will ever see a successful totalitarian takeover of the United States. It's a genuinely successful totalitarian takeover of this country. Because people, and that you would never see that of any country long term. You might see it that would last for a decade. You might see it that would last even for a generation or two. North Korea, case in point. But eventually it will crumble because people will fight for their homes. People will fight for their families. And so rather than arming the populace because we're afraid that in Glenn Beck style, someday the government's going to come and get us, I think that what we should be doing is strengthening the institutions of civil society so that we have a stronger say in who and who our government is and what its policies are.
Oh, I agree there. I agree with you 99.5% of the time. I just wanted to give you an experience.
Okay.
I mean, I personally feel if Dick Cheney had his way and things went wrong, like a big economic crash or something, he'd be a guy that would try to institute something like that.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree. That in fact, Dick Cheney was, you know, in large part, my understanding is, behind the effort to do away with posse comitatus laws that go back to the 1860s that said, or 1870s, that said that the U.S. military may never turn their guns on U.S. civilians. And
Correct.
But still, I don't think that, you know, a bunch of people, you, me, my brother, my friends, whatever, a bunch of us armed with anything from a 22, you know, target pistol to a 357, you know, Magnum to frankly, an Uzi with a 50 round clip. We're not going to stop, you know, the Army. We're not going to stop Navy SEALs. We're not going to stop the U.S. Air Force. We're not going to stop the Marine Corps. They're going to come in, and if we try and fight back, they're going to blow us to smithereens. So, you know, the way to deal with an oppressive government is not to arm yourself to the teeth. The way to deal with an oppressive government is to speak out very loudly when the government takes all those small incremental steps. And you know, we can see the history of this back in the first half of the 20th century in Europe, when the government takes those small incremental steps towards tyranny, like, you know, clamping down on individual groups, clamping down on the rights of free speech, invading our privacy. I mean, there's a bill right now that's being debated in Congress. Pat Leahy just pulled day before yesterday his support for this bill. You can see the video of it over at TomHartmann.com of my talking with Amy Stepanovich last night. From one of these privacy groups that says that basically, you know, the feds can read your email all day long if they want, without a judge,
Correct.
Without a warrant, in violation of the Fourth Amendment. We need to be standing there, not standing someplace out on a street corner with a loaded pistol.
Yeah, well, the average person, the average voter, is more worried about taking Johnny to Little League and Mary to soccer than they are their own freedoms.
Well, but taking Johnny to Little League and Mary to soccer is part of our freedoms. But I don't disagree with you that the average American is not all that well informed about politics or about the direction that our country's going. We'll leave it at that, Jim. Thank you very much for the call. Dominic in Argyle, New York. Hey, Dominic. Most responsible
Hi,
people
Tom,
who own weapons
you?
Don't want to blow people away. I agree.
To save a little, very little time. But anyway, just taking off that last that caller,
mm-hmm.
You made some wonderful points about why it's necessary. It's interesting how you espouse the need for us to speak loudly as they incrementally take those little freedoms, and you completely ignore that one of the freedoms is the freedom to bear arms. That's just one point.
I'm not saying that, you know, no, Dominic, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that people should not be allowed to arm themselves. What I'm saying is that if the government were to go full bore Dick Cheney on us, it ain't going to matter.
Yeah, we can agree or disagree on that, but let's look at some other factors. Okay, I was listening to you about the picture. The picture is an innocuous picture of a person who made a decision to have her child on Santa's lap with an AK-47.
Right.
If you look at statistically, if you look at the amount of deaths and assaults by firearms and compare that to a number of other statistics that are out there, in comparison, they pale. For instance, the assault of with a vehicle. Okay, and we're talking about all various kind of assaults. So the boyfriend who gets mad at the girlfriend.
But how many people have vehicles? Pretty much everybody. I mean, I don't have one, but most people do.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you'd be surprised at how many people actually own weapons as compared to how many use them irresponsibly. And this is the part that the media hypes up so much.
Well, then let's just be honest about that, Dominic, and let's agree on that and say, you know, if you have to have a license that demonstrates that you have proven proficiency to move a 6,000-pound piece of steel 70 miles an hour down the highway, you have to have a similar license demonstrating that you have shown proficiency and safety to handle a 4.5-pound weapon that fires a 45 caliber piece of lead at muzzle velocity or whatever it is. What's wrong with that?
Well, nobody's saying that there's anything wrong with that, except that when you get into some of the finer points of gun ownership, there's a huge disconnect between reality and what the media...
Yeah, no, I'm not going in some wild-eyed rant. I agree with you. Most gun owners are responsible people.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And as responsible, and you know, many of them that I know have, you know, carry permits that, you know, where they have demonstrated proficiency and an understanding of safety. That's a fine thing.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
Let's check into the news. Our Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Governor Siegelman, and he has the ability to do it. And he's so far this year, in fact, in quite some time, he's only pardoned a couple of turkeys. Time to pardon Don Siegelman. Go to free-don.org. Don is not a turkey. He's a good man. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com. And Victoria, it's always great to see your smiling face. So what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Four women, a first lieutenant in the U.S. Marine Corps, a captain in the Marine Corps Reserves, a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army Reserves, and a major in the U.S. Air National Guard filed suit today against the Department of Defense, challenging its rules restricting women in combat under the Fifth Amendment.
Wow. Let's see. Fifth Amendment, that's due process?
Well, they're joined by the Advocacy Service Women's Action Network. They're accusing the DOD of violating service women's rights to equal protection under the law.
That's the 14th Amendment.
Well, it says here the Fifth, so that's interesting. Huh. By maintaining policies collectively known as the Combat Exclusion Rule.
Uh-huh.
So maybe my story has it wrong. They say the Fifth, but yeah, it must be the 14th.
Yeah, the Fifth Amendment guarantees due process. The 14th Amendment guarantees due process to everybody.
It has to be the 14th,
yeah.
So anyway, they've all served in Afghanistan or Iraq, and two are Purple Hearts recipients. They filed suit in the U.S. District Court in San Francisco this afternoon. Mm-hmm. Now, the Pentagon is reforming the policies directed at service women, but the rules do still bar women in the U.S. military from specific combat positions, positions that are available to men.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is that, do you know if that is usual or unusual among the nations of the developed world with regard to their armies?
It's changing. Most nations do have, I believe, some restrictions, and a few nations are lifting restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But more and more nations are looking at it.
Right.
Now, Pentagon officials say that they plan to develop gender-neutral physical standards and research further reform to the combat exclusion policies. In fact, Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, has directed the services a little while ago to update him in November with an evaluation of the reforms and an assessment of the remaining barriers to full implementation of a gender-neutral assignment policy.
Right.
Also, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, who's a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has introduced legislation calling for repeal of the combat exclusion policies as part of the Senate's version of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Is that new NDAA, by the way, going to roll back or walk back some of the we can kill you if we don't like you without a trial stuff?
Well, Senator Rand Paul is working on that, and he's pushing very hard to get a vote on his amendment. And all the other senators are kind of like, oh, Rand, you're being awkward, but he's holding out on this.
Well, God bless him. You know, it's, and I'm surprised that there are not more senators who are, because this seems like the kind of thing that would be universally popular, you know, maybe not with presidents who want to have, you know, more power than they should, but with everybody else.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that it was sort of sorted out last year, but it really wasn't, because what they sorted out last year, as my very poor memory drags up, is that what they kind of decided to do was that they said, well, we're going to say that what it says is that it doesn't change anything from what it previously said, and we didn't really understand what it previously said.
Right, and therefore the ambiguity remains.
Exactly.
Unambiguously.
That's what it said. And so the president said, well, I'm going to issue a signing statement saying I won't do it. And everybody said, well, it doesn't mean the next president won't do
it. Right, right. Yeah, it's unambiguous ambiguity. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
Speaking of women, are you familiar with this protest that happened in John Boehner's office today?
I absolutely am.
Now, a bunch of men and women got naked in front of John Boehner's office and, protesting what?
They were AIDS activists, three women AIDS activists, saying they wanted to highlight the naked truth about potential spending cuts in HIV programs, and they were arrested today after they took their clothes off in the lobby of House Speaker John Boehner's office.
But my understanding is only the women got arrested.
Well, that's because the four men ran off.
Oh, you're kidding!
Or at least, let me put it this way, the AP story correctly says appeared to have left.
Now I'm embarrassed for my gender. I thought that perhaps this was sort of like, you know, in New York during the Occupy protests, the New York City Police Department, some of the less savory elements of it would go out of their way to arrest women so that they could humiliate them. I mean, you know, this is kind of an old practice in despotic regimes. And I thought maybe that was what was going on, but apparently not. Just the men were more fleet of foot.
Started.
Yeah. Okay.
The trio had the words AIDS cuts kill painted on their bodies and had linked arms with the four men who also disrobed as part of the protest. Right. And, of course, they're worried about cuts because of the congressional discussions about the fiscal cliff.
Right.
And one of the protesters said he's HIV positive and depends on Medicaid for treatment.
Mm.
And, of course, Medicaid is one of the programs that is being discussed. However, the president is probably less likely to go for Medicaid as an option for cuts than he has been in the past, now that Medicaid is so much a part of Obamacare.
Right.
And he wants to make it work.
Right. Yeah, what he needs to be cutting is the subsidies to the oil industry. But just my editorial comment.
And I think that is very much on the table.
Yeah. So what else is going on?
Also today, PFC Bradley Manning is expected to testify and may already have done about his treatment during a pretrial hearing set to start today and run through Sunday in the military court of Fort Meade. This is, of course, the WikiLeaks trial.
Right. And he's
hoping to avoid trial by claiming he's already been punished enough when he was locked up alone in a small cell and forced to sleep naked for several nights.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Inch by inch, step by step, is Obamacare going to be taken down by the 9 unelected kings and queens on the United States Supreme Court? They've already basically said states can, you know, opt out of some of these provisions, and they don't have to take the Medicare money and or Medicaid money. Actually, let's talk to somebody who knows much more about this than I do. Ethan Rome is the executive director of Healthcare for America Now, HCAN, Healthcare for F-O-R, AmericaNow.org is their website, Twitter at HCAN. And Ethan, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So I understand that the next challenge to, first of all, if you could just summarize for me how the Supreme Court in the past has, you know, what small bites have the Supreme Court taken out of Obamacare?
The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the law. They ruled that it was constitutional. And the one thing that they did is that they said that the Medicaid expansion in the law was optional for states and not required.
And so you've got Rick Scott down in Florida saying, no, I'm not going to take $100 million, even though it's all free for the first 3 years after that, 90% free. Ain't going to take it because we just want to, you know, make people suffer and have them blame the president or whatever. I don't know what his motivation is, but it's
well, I mean, you've got people like Rick Perry in Texas saying, I'm going to stand on principle. And my principle is that a quarter of the people in my state have no insurance, and I'm going to make sure they don't get any.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually a much better and blunter way to say it. So that's chunk one or bite one into Medicare that the Supreme Court took, or into, excuse me, Obamacare that the Supreme Court took. Now there's another one that's being teed up. My understanding is we have several lower courts that have ruled in conflicting ways on the employer mandate with regard to employers who claim that they have a religious or moral objection to having to pay for health insurance that might pay for birth control pills that arguably are causing abortions. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. But I want to step back and say that, and start with the most important thing,
okay,
which is that this law for people who have insurance coverage does a remarkable, extraordinary thing, which is that it provides free preventive care. And for women, that means no-cost contraception no matter where you work. And it's revolutionary. And
because pregnancy is a medical condition, and if you want to prevent it, you should be able to.
It gives women and their families the ability to be in charge of their own families and their own health care,
right,
and their own bodies.
Right.
And that is obviously a very fundamental choice, and it is a freedom. And this law has established and protects that.
Okay, but that is exactly what is under assault, or may well be under assault, when these arguments go before the Supreme Court. Do I have this right?
Yes, there's several dozen lawsuits right now across the country that are challenging that part of the law. Mm-hmm. And, the frustrating part about it is that they're not brought about by a single employer or organization that supports the law. Right? So in terms of morality, these folks aren't so moral as to say, hey, we have to make sure that every single person in this country has health insurance, and we're going to see to it that that happens. And so I respect a lot of the folks who are bringing these suits, but taken together and along with Speaker Boehner and the Republicans' continued opposition in the House of Representatives, what it all comes together in is just more opposition to a law that we passed in March of 2010.
Right. This is really just people saying Obama passed it. We hate him. We're gonna try and take this law down.
Right. And the only problem is that the country didn't agree on the 6th of November.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, we have a president who won handily. We have Senate increasing their margin. And across the country, what we have is the lowest number of people saying that they want to repeal this law in its history. So we've got a law that has really strong support.
But none of that matters to the Supreme Court. They're not elected. They don't have to answer to public opinion, although you could argue that, when in 1937, after the election of 36, when Franklin Roosevelt tried to pack the court, that the court actually started changing the way that they made decisions, even though the makeup of the court didn't change, in large part because of the public debate about their obstructionism with regard to the New Deal. But I don't see that kind of noise being made about the current court. It's possible, I suppose, if the president was to get behind an effort to amend the Constitution about Citizens United, for example. Here we have, nine people, unelected, in robes, just three blocks from where I'm sitting, who have given themselves the power, actually, in 1803 in a case called Marbury versus Madison. It's not in the Constitution. Gave themselves the power to strike down laws passed by Congress.
It's funny, Tom. All of that is true, and I am not a constitutional scholar, and I'm not even that smart about these issues. What I do know is this: nobody predicted, except for ardent supporters of Obamacare, but everybody else said that this Supreme Court, under the conservative leadership of Justice Roberts, was never going to uphold Obamacare, mm-hmm. and yet they did.
Mm-hmm.
And their decision was then ratified by the electorate. So I just don't see these cases going anywhere. The Liberty case is going to go back to the Fourth District Circuit and die.
You think so?
It's a liberal circuit, likely to have the same panel that already ruled on it. Mm-hmm. Two of the three folks that ruled on it on the merits support the law. So I don't think this case is going to go anywhere. That's why the Obama administration, the Department of Justice said, go ahead. They didn't object when the Supreme Court raised it.
Yeah. So what is going to happen before the Supreme Court? Or is this just a matter of the court kicking it back down to the Fourth Circuit?
I mean, in this instance, the simple issue is that the Supreme Court remanded it back to the Circuit Court because what the Circuit Court ruled was that they couldn't rule on the case.
On the mandate because it was not in effect yet.
Yeah, because it was not in effect. And what that means simply is that the Supreme Court is giving the Circuit Court the opportunity to rule on the issues that they did not yet rule on.
Right. And you're convinced that they're going to rule in favor of Obamacare. This is a non-issue. Don't get hysterical. Don't worry.
I think two things. One is I think that the Fourth Circuit will rule in favor of the law.
Right.
And second, I don't think we're going to see one of these cases make it to the Supreme Court. And if it were, I think we will see the Supreme Court uphold the law in its fullness.
But John Roberts, in order to uphold the fundamental constitutionality of Obamacare, had to basically twist himself into pretzels. And if the reports from inside the court are true, he did so just in the last 3 weeks before the decision came down, much to the shock and horror of his peers. Might he be looking to redeem himself with conservatives, or might he be there another change of mind be coming down the road? Or do you think he's going to dig in his heels and say, no, I've planted my flag here. I'm going to stand with it.
I mean, I think that I don't understand the internal dynamics of the court, and I don't pretend the way a lot of folks do to understand what happens.
Right.
All I know is this. He may have twisted himself into a pretzel, but he did when it mattered, and I think he will again.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe they don't need to take this up again.
Yeah. It's going to be very interesting. We're talking with Ethan Rome. He's the Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, HCAN. HealthcareForAmericaNow.org is the website. And this sounds, Ethan, you've given us all what I think is some good news. So thank you for that.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Obamacare has lived through every battle, and it's going to continue to, and we're going to implement this, and insurance is going to get better in this country.
From your lips to God's ears. Let's hope so. Ethan Rome, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Ethan Rome with HealthcareForAmericaNow.org. We'll be back 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, the thing about Obamacare that most interests me is that in 2 years, these waivers are going to roll out, and all of a sudden, Vermont's going to have a single-payer health care system. That's going to be contagious.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy, it hurts.
Yes, our I'm too sexy alert for the day. The Onion. You know, The Onion, the satire, pastiche newspaper, now a website. The Onion put out an article saying that North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un is the sexiest man alive. China's People's Daily, their nationwide newspaper, over a billion people, ran a 55-page photo spread as a tribute to to Kim Jong-un, because this American newspaper, The Onion, had picked him out as the sexiest man alive. The headline said, North Korea's top leader named The Onion's sexiest man alive for 2012. And here's what the Chinese newspaper wrote, quoting from The Onion's spoof report. I mean, you know, clearly The Onion's making this stuff up. With his devastatingly handsome round face, his boyish charm, and his strong, sturdy frame, this Pyongyang-bred heartthrob is every woman's dream come true. Blessed with an air of power that masks an unmistakable, cute, cuddly side, Kim made this newspaper's editorial board swoon with his impeccable fashion sense, chic hair, short hairstyle, and, of course, that famous smile. Someone at the People's Daily is in a whole world of hurt right now, which probably we shouldn't be making jokes about. But anyway, Mark in Birmingham, Michigan, listening to WDTW 1310 AM. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah, I was just listening to your previous caller, and he really hit the nail on the head that Obamacare is going to revolutionize or is going to take care of insurance, but what it doesn't do is deal with health care. And any time you have these type of
actually, it does. It does. Oh. Obamacare, for the first time, is providing free preventative health care. And free preventative health care, independent of your insurance company, free preventative health care is a BFD. I mean, it's huge. It means a lot more stage one cancers are going to get discovered rather than stage four cancers being treated. It means a
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly.
How are you going to control the allocation of visits to the doctor? How are you going to prevent people from just going to the doctor with every little ailment when they think psychologically, oh, the government's paying for it, I need to go every time I have a runny nose? In countries like Canada, where they have these systems, the resources are used up on these maintenance, like as if
Mark, I'm sorry.
Mark, you need
to take off the tinfoil hat and stop reading, you know, the Glenn Beck websites. They don't have that problem in Canada, and we don't have that problem in the United States. There are a lot of insurance policies right now that people have that don't have deductibles for doctor's visits. And there's not this stampede of people going to hassle their doctors. Most people have better things to do. They'd rather go out and watch the new James Bond movie. And, you know, yes, there may be a small percentage of people who are hypochondriacs who show up at the doctor way too often with or without insurance. And frankly, doctors have figured this out. You know, they know when these people, who these people are, and they don't see them, or they give them sugar pills, or they in some cases there's an underlying condition, or they realize that it's a psychiatric disorder that person is suffering from, and they refer them to a shrink. But that's that of all the objections to universal health care, that is the weakest, because it has never happened in any country anywhere.
There's no rationing anywhere in the world, in England, Canada. There's none.
There's rationing here in the United States. There's a hell of a lot of rationing here in the United States. And the rationing is so that the big health insurance companies like United Healthcare can skim 20% off the top and use it to pay over 100 executives over $1 million a year.
And there's no waste in government.
We have serious
fraud.
There's an enormous amount of waste and fraud in these large for-profit health insurance companies. Mind-boggling amounts of waste and fraud. With their private jets, with gold-plated bathroom faucets and nice, you know, chinaware for the executives to fly around the world in and fly off to their country homes and vacation spots. Are you kidding me? There's enormous fraud and waste in our for-profit health care system.
You're ignoring government waste.
Medicare operates on an overhead of 3%.
Oh my God!
Medicare operates. Mark, look it up.
I can't believe you're defending
the government. Medicare operates on an overhead of 3%. TRICARE, the government services that are provided for our veterans, operates on an overhead of around 4%. Medicaid is a little less than 3%. They're all in that 3 to 4% range. That's about what the Medicare system in Canada, the national healthcare system, costs. 3, 4, 5% is the basic administrative cost in any of the healthcare systems all over the world. And there's all kinds of different variations on them. In Switzerland, for example, there's no national healthcare system, but it's kind of like Obamacare. You're required to be insured, but for-profit corporations are not allowed to exist in that company in the health insurance business, and so it's all not-for-profits. So, again, they have half the cost of health care that we have here in the United States. They insure all of their citizens. Mark, you really need to get out of the United States just for a week. Trust me, I've been there. I have used the healthcare services in Australia. I got really, really sick in Australia. In fact, the week before 9/11, I got really, really, I got food poisoning out in the bush, and I just walked into a clinic. In fact, I walked into that clinic three times over the next 4 or 5 days because it took a couple of different antibiotics to kill off what I had. Because it was really nasty. It was Giardia.
I lived in Canada for 10 years. I know the rationing that goes on. I know the Canadians that have to come to the United States because if they wait for the type of treatment they need, they will die or get sicker.
Mark,
so
not true.
You're
not true. And I, you know, I guarantee
you,
right now, you, what you are causing to happen, although I think all our lines are full, but if there are, you know, when you drop off, at least one line will open up, is that we will now be flooded with calls since we're on Sirius XM, which is coast to coast in Canada, plus we're on a bunch of Pacifica stations in Canada, and people can see us on TV in Canada, on Free Speech TV, on Dish and DirecTV. We will get a bunch of calls from Canadians. This happens every time somebody says what you just said, saying, what? What are you talking about? You're crazy. And, you know, no offense, Mark, but it's just not true. And the rationing in the United States with the healthcare system that we have in this country is among the worst in the world. And we pay about twice what any other country in the world does on a per capita basis for healthcare. Why? So Stephen Hemsley can become a billionaire.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I frankly don't want any more health insurance billionaires in the United States. I would much rather that money was being used to pay for doctors and nurses and hospitals. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very stirquiliniously ugly. The good, Tom Ricks. How dare someone go on Fox so-called news and bash the network? At least that's what network executives and production staff were saying yesterday after Ricks, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, blasted the network's coverage of the Benghazi consulate attacks. Take a look.
I think that Benghazi generally was hyped by this network especially, and that now that the campaign is over, I think he's backing off a little bit. They're not going to stop Susan Rice from being Secretary of State. So when I see this focus on what was essentially a small firefight, I think, number one, I've covered a lot of firefights. It's impossible to figure out what happens in them sometimes. And second, I think that the emphasis on Benghazi has been extremely political, partly because Fox was operating as a wing of the Republican Party.
All right. Tom Ricks, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And get the heck off the set. Rick's interview was supposed to be 4 minutes long, but he was cut off after speaking what can only be described as an uncomfortable truth. Kudos to you, Tom, for calling out Fox so-called news on their flow of unfair and unbalanced misinformation. The bad. Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli. Everyone's favorite far-right crackpot attorney general is at it again. This time, Cuccinelli went on WMAL radio in Virginia and suggested that President Obama stole the election. When one of the radio show hosts argued that President Obama couldn't win a state that had voter suppression ID laws in place, Cuccinelli agreed. Take a listen.
There needs to be a way for people to be able to report this stuff and have it looked into. I mean, just across the country, we're hearing so many stories, and people can talk about it, but nothing seems to be done. And, in fact, in the states where voter ID is required to
photo
vote,
ID.
Photo ID, voter photo ID, Obama lost every one of those states. He can't win in a state where photo ID is required. So clearly there's something going on out there. And until there's a way to have something done about it, where when you report it, you know it's going to be looked into, the other side just says, oh, well, you know, this,
look,
you're just
Gary,
poor losers
look,
and that sort of thing.
Your tone suggests you're a little upset with me. You're preaching to the choir.
No, we get
I'm
that.
Upset with you.
I'm with you completely.
Oh, my. First, President Obama actually did win 4 states with photo ID laws in effect. But look at the irony here. Republicans put photo ID laws in place to help rig the election for Mitt Romney, and yet they're now accusing President Obama of doing the very same thing they were trying to do, rig the election. And the very, very ugly Márton Gyarmati, a leader in Hungary's far-right Jobbik political party, Gyarmati called for the Hungarian government to compile a list of Jews who could pose potential national security risks. Not surprisingly, the request angered thousands, and Gyarmati issued an apology saying he was only referring to his citizens with dual Israeli-Hungarian citizenship. The appalling request comes in the wake of the turmoil in the Middle East and the fighting between Israelis and Palestinians. Needless to say, his comments sound very Nazi-esque and are very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Me, oh, me, oh, me. Okay. Jeff in Canton, Michigan, listening on 1310 AM WDTW. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, you know, these myths about the Canadian system or any socialized system or single-payer system are so ridiculous. Anybody who knows anything about the Canadian system understands that although there's government health care, there is also a private sector health care. It is very small, and the reason it is very small is because the government system is so good. And in addition to that, you do have options in the Canadian system. You have the ability to buy better insurance if you want to pay out of pocket.
Right.
It is nothing like what these people describe.
Right.
And
by the way, that's true of every country with private health insurance or with the National Health Service. England actually tried for about a decade to outlaw private practitioners in their national health care system. Under public pressure, they had to give in and say, okay, if rich people want to, you know, be able to buy an extra insurance policy so that they can get a private room or even a private floor in a hospital, have their own special doctors or whatever, that's fine. They can do that. But the bottom line is everybody has health care.
Right. And nobody's left to die in Canada. Nobody's left in an emergency room unattended.
No.
Even in our system here, we have priority health care where depending on your condition or the situation, you're treated on the basis of the situation. And the thing that is most hilarious to me is that, the right free market argument fails so badly in the situation that if you took the Canada system, their argument is wherever there's a need, the free market can triumph. Okay. It can't in Canada because the government system, the public system, is too good. If it wasn't, a private sector health system would overpower it because people would demand it. Their own argument fails.
Yeah, and because
that's ridiculous about
right, because that private sector system is there, and it is in Germany, and it is in France, and it is in Switzerland, and it is in Sweden, and it is in Norway, and it's on and on and on, and in the UK, it's pretty much everywhere. And basically, you know, it's just for the people who can afford to say, okay, I want, you know, and it's not a better service, not better medical service. It's better accoutrements. It's a private room, you know, with a view rather than sharing a room with somebody else. It's 5-star catered meals rather than hospital food. It's that kind of thing. It's not a difference in the quality of service. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Thank you very much, Jeff, for making the call. I have lived virtually my entire life. I suppose about a 13-year exception when we lived in Georgia. But most of my life, I've lived within 150 miles of the Canadian border. And I have never seen a Canadian looking for health care in the United States. However, when we lived in Montpelier, every Sunday, Bernie Sanders and the buses would line up. And people would get on them, and they'd go up to Montreal, just 200 miles north of us or 150 miles north, a couple hours north of us, and buy their pharmaceuticals at incredible discounts. Not discounts, at Canadian prices, which are much lower than American prices. Same drugs, and very often made in the United States even. Ross in Pittsboro, North Carolina. Hey, Ross, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Want to give a shout-out, first of all, to Free Speech TV. Remember to support this great programming.
Thank you.
And I want to touch on something real quickly that you were talking about in the last hour, talking about kind of guns in general. And I would like to point out that guns are an important tool for feeding yourself, or they can be. Depending on where you live, you can supplement your diet to great effect.
When we lived in Vermont, I knew
nutritionally superior products.
Yeah, there were we knew people in Vermont who were not earning a lot of income, and getting a deer every year was a good chunk of their meat supply for the year. I don't have a problem.
Yeah,
with that.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
I choose not to eat dead animals, but I don't have a problem with somebody doing that.
Right, right. And so I would say that if you do eat meat, then killing an animal yourself is
it's the most honest way to do it.
A way to do it than going to the grocery store.
Yeah, it's the high integrity way to do it, as opposed to paying somebody to torture and torment and kill an animal on your behalf, in a place where you don't have to see it. It's the same as my rant about we didn't end slavery in America. We just exported it. We no longer had to look our slaves in the eyes. We no longer had to look the animals that we're about to eat in the eye before we kill them. And
excellent point. Excellent point about slavery as well. That's really, really good point you're making on that subject. Another thing I'd like to touch on is earlier in this hour you had Ethan Rome on discussing aspects of Obamacare. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is being discussed is, you know, contraceptives and abortion as well. And, you know, I would just like to point out that I think there are some substantial ways that universal access to abortion ends up benefiting Republicans, these people who want to suppress the vote and make it harder for minorities to vote and make it make the minorities lower in number on the voter rolls. It's worth pointing out that there's a hypothesis, the Donahue-Levitt hypothesis, that points out a correlation in reduced crime rate.
That was published in the book Freakonomics, that the fewer unwanted children there are, a generation later, the fewer crimes are committed.
Right.
As those unwanted children, you know, grow up to be adults, if there are fewer of them, then there are fewer problematic adults.
Right, exactly. I would point out that that was an effect that was predicted by a study in 1972 done in Sweden, a racially sterile country, for all effects, you know, statistically. And it was a study by a Rockefeller Foundation or a Rockefeller Commission of some sort. So these effects were predicted, and I think it's obvious, really, that if the numbers were reduced in an amount that led to a reduced crime rate, that it would follow that the numbers on the voter rolls were reduced.
Yeah, that's getting uncomfortably close to eugenics. And Ross, there have also been people who believe that they have debunked the Freakonomics study, the suggestion that crime rate would go down. The original hypothesis was based on abortion being decriminalized in the United States in 1973 with Roe v. Wade, and then, you know, 15 years later, seeing a decrease in the crime rate in the United States in the 1980s and the early 1990s, particularly throughout the 90s. And, you know, what the people who have debunked that theory point out is that during that period of time, unemployment went down, the economy was booming, and during those times, you generally have lower crime rates than before. So it may have had nothing to do with abortion. So, you know, we have to be careful about these figured
out
things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It may or may not be. So, you know, just a caveat in there. Because I know all the fact checker folks are going to be all over me on that one. We'll be back.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Eric, listening to us in Illinois on WCPT out of Chicago. Hey, Eric, you wanted to talk about healthcare.
As regards to the other caller was saying, as far as the rationing of our medical services, I've been involved with emergency medicine for 30 years, and I can tell you for a fact in the U.S., we have rationing. The simplest form to look at is that when you go to the emergency room and you come into my emergency room and you have a cut finger, you're going to wait because I have to deal with the person that's having the chest pains and having the heart attack.
Right.
It's the same when you call the doctor's office for, I'm having a knee pain. Well, go ahead and schedule it. And when I can get to you in a couple of weeks, I'll get to you. If it's really bad, go to the ER and they'll look at you, but I'll get to you when I can get to you. So to say we don't have rationing in the U.S. is hogwash. We do. It's a triage system.
Mm-hmm.
The people that are really sick need to be seen immediately. The people that are kind of sick, well, we'll get to you when we
right.
can.
And the two big problems that we have that make healthcare so expensive in the United States is that first we have 45, 50 million people without health insurance or without access to decent health insurance. Probably if you look at these, you know, high deductible premiums like people who work at Walmart get, you know, probably the number goes up to like 60, 70, 80 million people who just don't go to the doctor because they can't afford it. They're, you know, and so their diseases don't get caught early. They're ending up, you know, showing up in the ER, in your ER room, you know, going blind because they're getting diabetic retinopathy or something like that, you know, when they should have been on insulin for the last year. And yep. And so A, we've got all these uninsured people, which is costing us a fortune at the end of the day. And then B, we've got these for-profit health insurance companies, which are just banks. Everybody treats them like they're some kind of sacred lifesavers. I'm sorry. Health insurance companies have, Stephen J. Hemsley has never given any kid, to the best of my knowledge, a vaccination. He's never looked in anybody's throat. He's never checked out anybody for serious disease. They're banksters. They handle money. Why do we give them billions, trillions of dollars and treat them like they're royalty? It makes no sense. I don't understand why people who call themselves conservatives or Republicans would even say, yes, we're going to go to the mat to fight for these banksters.
Yep. The mindset in the U.S. has to change, and that mindset is that we need to work on preventative care, and that then if you are a for-profit, I like you better because you're healthier, you're paying me money, and I'm not having to shell out to take care of you.
Yeah.
So if we start turning the corner and looking more at preventative health care and stuff like that, that really is the direction that we should be going. So this, the care that women can now get and all that is really a positive step.
It really is, Eric. And I don't know if it's an apocryphal story or if it's actual fact, but when I was studying acupuncture in Beijing in 1986, November of 1986, one of the doctors there told me that back in the old days, like hundreds of years ago or maybe 1,000 years ago in China, the way it used to work was you paid your doctor when you were healthy, and when you got sick, your doctor paid you. In other words, your doctor made sure that your cost of living, all your needs to be supported if you couldn't work, or your food, a doctor would bring you food or whatever. And so the doctor had a real incentive to keep you healthy. But, it seemed like kind of like I said, it's probably apocryphal. It's probably just a story, but it's an interesting model anyway, of wellness, because let's incentivize the healthcare system to keep people healthy rather than incentivizing them to only treat illness. Makes sense.
And I think that's where originally the system for the HMOs kind of their thought process started, and then the doctors realized that, well, wait a minute, if I treat you less, then I get more money. And again, the system, it failed, and the system's wrong, and it definitely needs to be taken apart and relooked at and all that.
Yeah, I agree.
And these CEOs making the filthy money they're making, it's just an atrocity.
Yeah, and Obamacare is certainly no panacea. I would much rather have a national health care system, but I have a feeling that once these waivers kick in 2014 or 2016, that it will allow Vermont and Montana to go with a single-payer national health care system or a single-payer statewide health care system, just like Saskatchewan did back in the mid-50s or mid-60s, It's going to go viral. Every other state is going to want it as well. Eric, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. David in Minneapolis, listening to AM 950, Minnesota's progressive voice. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment about some of like Rick Perry and company.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Yeah. You're on the air.
Yeah, and the reasons why they're resisting healthcare, and the reasons sound stupid. And it seems to me that what's really going on here, bottom line, is that what we need and will eventually get is single-payer national health care, that Obamacare is a road to get there.
Mm-hmm. It's a transitional process.
It's going to put the health care insurance companies out of business, and they know it too. And that's why they're really fighting.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. The Stephen J. Helmsleys of the world are protecting their billion-dollar incomes. And, all the multimillion-dollar CEOs or senior executives in all these companies.
Yeah, and all of the other reasons for resisting Obamacare, that it's rationing. You've had so many callers that are against it for this, that, the other reason, with their tinfoil hats. And those people have just bought in to specious arguments put on by people who are going to be put out of business, and they're fighting it.
Yes.
As well they should.
And many of those folks tragically don't understand what the word specious means. So it's even worse than that. David, thank you for the call. Well said. Very well said. I got the smartest listeners on earth. I'll tell you, it's one of the privileges of doing this show. Coming up tomorrow, a special Conversations of the Great Minds interview this week featuring writer and speaker William Hoagland, author of the brilliant new book, Founding Finance. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It's not a spectator sport. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.